From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I'm from Pacific Heights.
I'm from Milpitas.
Union City.
Mission Bay.
I do not know where I'm from.
Coming up, we'll find out why San Francisco is moving tons of sand down Ocean Beach.
Well, we would never let this happen. So worst case scenario, if that got exposed and somehow ruptured, we'd have a sewage spill into the Pacific Ocean.
Then an artist makes a name for himself in the big city, defying family expectations.
Like, they really didn't know how to foster or encourage me to pursue art as a career because nobody else did it, so it wasn't even reality.
And women drummers unite in the East Bay.
The drum wrongly was personified as a male instrument. We all know that the drum is a woman. The drum is female. The heartbeat.
Marching to your own beat. Today on Cross Currents. If you've been down to Ocean Beach in San Francisco lately, you may have noticed huge dump trucks hauling loads of sand from the north end of the beach near the beach chalet 2.5 miles down the Great Highway to the intersection of Sloat Boulevard. That area is eroding fast. It's just one battle in a war between humans and nature that's been going on at the beach for decades. This is not the first time the city's put up this fight. KALW's Audrey Dilling headed to the water's edge to bring us field notes from the fray.
In this war, San Francisco's tanks look more like Tonka trucks. The dump trucks line up along the beach. A machine with a huge scoop at the end fills each one up with sand. Then they turn around and head south in an orderly procession. They dump the sand and turn around and come back. They're doing this until they've moved all the sand they need to move, which is a lot of sand. So we're gonna do about 1,000 truckloads in the course of the next few weeks. Gene Walsh is with the San Francisco Public Utilities Commission, or SFPUC. The point is to protect a water treatment plant the SFPUC operates down near Sloat Boulevard. There's a pipe there that releases treated wastewater into the ocean. The sand surrounding the pipe plays a big role in protecting it from being battered by waves. But the ocean currents have a habit of sweeping that sand miles away, all the way up to the beach where Walsh and I are standing, leaving the area around the plant vulnerable.
Yeah, I mean, it's just a constant battle.
It really is a battle. There are even ruins. The erosion has exposed a couple of old seawalls and the remnants of a pedestrian tunnel built about 100 years ago. Artifacts from times we've tried to hold off the sea and failed. But in the case of the sewer plant, we can't give up.
Well, we would never let this happen. So worst case scenario, if that got exposed and somehow ruptured, we'd have a sewage spill into the Pacific Ocean.
The wastewater plant was built in 1993. Soon after that, the city noticed the erosion problem and responded aggressively, installing concrete barriers around the pipe and along the beach. The barriers worked, but environmentalists and beach visitors weren't happy about the jagged blocks cluttering the shoreline. Meanwhile, storms continued to ravage the coastline south of Sloat. So the city tried to get a permit to build more barriers, but the California Coastal Commission denied it and said they needed a new strategy. Hence the dump trucks. They first showed up in 2012.
I never remembered them doing this at all when I was growing up. So.
Pierre Braganza is a civilian bystander in this war. He grew up out here in the Sunset District.
I've been out here my whole life, and it's funny because, you know, the stairs, I remember as a kid, you used to run down these stairs, and it was kind of long.
Nowadays, you don't even need the stairs sometimes because the sand is piled so high.
You know, I guess you gotta, you know, be a little bit proactive, or else nature will probably just take over everything, you know?
A lot of this area actually used to belong to the sea. Early San Franciscans pushed the beach about 200 feet west to level out dunes and make room for the Great Highway, the road that runs parallel to the shoreline. And ever since, the ocean has been trying to advance its way back, eroding the land under the road or covering it with enough sand that it often needs to be closed and cleared out during windy months. The city knows this, which is why the dump trucks aren't a permanent solution.
You can have free-flowing traffic, you can have a wastewater infrastructure system, and you can have a sandy beach. You can sort of have any two of those three, but you really can't have them all.
Benjamin Grant is Urban Design Policy Director for the city planning think tank SPUR, And he's landed himself in the position of Commander-in-Chief of San Francisco's long-term battle plan against erosion and sea level rise. Grant and his army of spur staff have been concocting a strategy that takes everyone's needs into account. Environmental agencies, beach visitors, wildlife. It's called the Ocean Beach Master Plan. Grant says they had three main tactics to choose from. One, coastal armoring.
Which stops the erosion, but also often degrades the landscape or the beach.
Like what the SFPUC already tried with the concrete barriers. Two, a full-on attack, padding the beach with a lot more sand to make it wider and hold off the ocean. That's like what the dump trucks are doing. Not a good long-term solution. So Spur has landed on a third option.
What's called managed retreat, which is essentially realigning threatened assets away from the erosion hazard.
In other words, we're giving the land back to the sea. Well, parts of it. The problem stretch of the Great Highway south of Slope Boulevard, the plan says that should go away as soon as 2020. And with traffic gone, the area returned to a natural coastal landscape. There will still be some protections around the treatment plant, but they won't need to work as hard, thanks to the other adaptations. At least, that's the idea. The Ocean Beach Master Plan is a series of recommendations that all need to get their own green light, by the city or the Coastal Commission, or for some of them, both. Grant says that'll take work, but if it gets passed, it would be huge.
The Ocean Beach Master Plan is one of the first examples of a specific location having a detailed long-term climate adaptation plan.
That means it could become a model for other areas.
What we see at Ocean Beach today is a condition that we're likely to see much more broadly in 50 and 100 years.
At Ocean Beach, Jean Walsh from the SFPUC says she's on board with the plan and ready to retreat.
So do you so Mother Nature is winning right now?
Yeah,
I would say so. And then in down the line in, say, 50 years, it'll be, so we'll be sort of at a truce, maybe?
I hope so. After a lot of money spent and a lot of thought put into it, and hopefully we'll come up with a sustainable long-term plan that works for everyone.
Including the ocean. In San Francisco, I'm Audrey Dilling for Cross Currents.
Work is expected to continue at Ocean Beach, closing the southbound lanes of Highway 1 every weekday from 7 a.m. to 4 p.m. till the end of the year. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hanat Baba. Muralist and painter Aaron de la Cruz grew up in a working-class Mexican-American family in Fresno. He spent his teen years honing his graffiti skills on walls and freeway overpasses, but not quite believing that art could be an actual career. So when he moved up to San Francisco to go to the California College of Arts and Crafts, he chose to study illustration, a practical major his parents could approve of. At first, he thought his tagging days were behind him, but over time, he integrated his old and new styles into his own distinctive blend. Now, his minimalist pattern-based pieces adorn walls from LA to Taiwan, and his paintings, murals, and sculptures both fulfill his passion and pay the bills. He sat down with KALW's Jen Chien to talk about how he's managed to bring together his two worlds of high art and a working-class identity.
I'm curious about how you feel, how you think about yourself in terms of street art and fine art. Those are two worlds that have been coming closer together over the years,
yes,
but in some ways are still separate. So kind of where are you situated?
I'm situated, I guess, in the gray area. Well, I don't personally, I mean, this is like no offense to anybody, the term street art, I don't ever use. I don't, like, if people say call me street artist, I kind of take, I'm like, no, I'm not a street artist, you know.
What does that mean to you? What's the,
well,
what's not right about it?
There's nothing wrong about it, because I have friends of mine who kind of, I guess, do the same type of work that I do and wear that title with pride. But I think because of when I first, I think when my parents first saw that I had something, my dad kind of like showed me like a lot of like, you know, old just Olmec, Mesoamerican art, and then, and kind of saying like, look, like, this is like our lineage, our people. This is like how we created before all this stuff. And then when I kept doing it, it was like Diego Rivera and, you know, the whole Mexican muralist movement and things of that sort. So that was whenever I was like, okay, I wanted, like, because I think he saw that graffiti was such, it's like something that's meant, was so powerful to me. He's like, look, he's like, these are people who are working in the same medium, like working on walls, big, like talking to the people, but conveying a message at the same time. And these are people that look like you. So I think wanting to be a muralist was something that I think I've always kind of sought to be, you know. I care a lot about people, and I care a lot about, in a way, like what's happening. And you know, I worked in public education for 10 years. So there's a lot of just different influences that I have. And I think just being like, I wouldn't say street artist, because I think that I'm not easy with just that one title in a way. So if that makes any sense. The good thing is, you know, I'm lucky enough that my work can go into these different mediums, but that's also like a really hard struggle too as well, because I'm kind of like, okay, like, you know, like, do I want to hop on all these different avenues or stay in one thing for a little while? So
I'm curious about, to follow that a little bit, just, you said that when you were in art school, your parents kind of nudged you to choose something a little more commercial, something with more money-making potential.
Yeah.
And you have gotten commissions and you've done things for more sort of corporate clients, as well as these more personal projects. Do you think about those different types of work differently, or do you feel like you're doing the same thing as an artist? Is your process the same if you're painting a mural inside the offices of a fashion label? Or, for example, there's a piece that you just did recently in my neighborhood in Excelsior that I think is probably a more personal piece. It's just on a boarded up storefront. Mm-hmm. In a collaboration with a friend. So do you think about those things differently?
Yeah, I do. And I guess before going into that, it's funny, like, I kind of go about the first time I got questioned about producing art for like money in a way is when I first came to art school. I remember having a conversation with like peers, and they're like, well, what are you doing? I was like, well, I'm producing work to, I want to make money off of my work. And not like that was the sole reason why I'm creating, but it was like, that's the only way I could survive, right? Like, if not, I'm going back to Fresno. And they were like, what? Like, you're a total sellout, this and that. And I remember I was like, I don't get it. Like, why all this anger towards wanting to produce a painting or whatever and sell it? And the reason why is because a lot of kids came from, I guess, better,
more privileged backgrounds.
Yes, more privileged backgrounds, exactly. And so that beat me up for a while, because I was like, man, am I even doing this for like the right reasons, you know? But once again, I think like just kind of going with your heart and just kind of chucking through it. When I do create pieces, whether it be for like a commission piece versus like public art, it's for the most part, my approach is kind of always the same. I don't have a sketch and then I say, okay, it's going to look exactly like this, which a lot of people can work in that way.
And a lot of muralists, that's a traditional way to make a mural.
Yeah. And so for me, I can say, well, it'll kind of feel something like this. You know, I can kind of general, like if there's going to be like some big shapes, I can kind of say, okay, well, this big shape will be there. But then the overall marks that I'm doing will kind of feel like this, but it's just going to happen right then and there. And some people are too afraid of that, and they were like, well, it's just too risky. But for the most part, people are on, you know, they're onto it. And I, you know, thank them for that, you know, because it's just me put onto a canvas or onto a wall, right?
I'm speaking with San Francisco visual artist Aaron De La Cruz. I have a question. It may be sort of meandering. I'm not quite sure what I mean, but you talked about growing up working class and moving out of Fresno, coming here to San Francisco. You went to school with a lot of privileged kids. You live now in a predominantly working class neighborhood, but in a city that's rapidly changing its demographics and its kind of economic realities. I'm wondering if you feel like being an artist, becoming an artist, and living the life that you live now can be reconciled with your upbringing, with your past? How do you feel yourself kind of in that spectrum or in that dynamic? Does that make sense?
No. You lost me at reconciled. So what?
From speaking with you, you strike me as someone who takes both a practical kind of workmanlike approach to your artistic process, but at the same time, you have a pretty deep philosophy and can speak about the theory behind your process as well.
Okay, yes.
So I'm wondering how those two kind of sides of yourself interrelate.
I can answer that. Okay, so I think because, you know, having a found like my parents growing up, right, like they really didn't know how to foster or encourage me to pursue art as a career because nobody else did it. So it wasn't even reality. It was like, okay, cool, you got a scholarship. We'll see you in a few years back here in Fresno. So, but I always looked at myself as not having like a foundation, a creative, an art foundation growing up. But growing up, my parents, we always like, we're always building things. Like my dad like taught my brother and I how to like lay cement. Like we tore down walls in our house and like added rooms. And this is just my mom, my dad, and my brother, you know, the four of us. You know, we put in the windows, we did everything. We created, but it was only by necessity, right? It was like just, and then my mom, she taught us how to sew, and she would tell us stories about when she made her clothes out of old flour sacks as a kid because, you know, they were poor growing up. So once again, it was like, you know, I had all this like knowledge of how to create, how to make things, but it wasn't for art's sake. It wasn't for, you know, for people to like buy. It was just to protect yourself. And, you know, so I think that's why even now I still work towards producing work that is about like people. I think one thing about, you know, graffiti is that I had access to this art form and these pieces that were being done, and they weren't in a gallery setting, right? They were, but it encouraged me to want to keep creating. I think it's, you know, I don't know if it's like my duty, but it's one thing that I make it a point to do is to always allow the public to engage with what I'm doing, whether that be by creating murals still or creating murals, or I do this thing where like I will create pieces of artwork that you can find in a gallery, but I'll put it and just say, hey, it's free, you know, come and get it. For me, the ultimate payoff is having a dialogue with people, and that's what pushes me.
That was artist Aaron De La Cruz speaking with KALW's Jen Chien. You can see one of his most recent murals in the Excelsior neighborhood in San Francisco at the corner of Mission and Onondaga. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. When it comes to music made by women, some cliches still persist. Women sing, men play loud guitars and heavy drums. Conga drummer Carolyn Brandy wants to change that. She's been playing drums for more than 40 years. You may have heard her with the percussion collective Sista Boom in San Francisco's Dyke Marches. She also accompanies other musicians from all over the world on their records. And most importantly, she encourages other women to grab the drumsticks or simply use their hands and make some noise through her organization, Women Drummers International.
My name is Carolyn Brandy. I'm the creator and executive director of Women Drummers International. And our mission is to promote the message of the drum for women and girls, a message that is about health, it's about community, it's about coming together. The drum wrongly was personified as a male instrument. We all know that the drum is a woman. The drum is female. The heartbeat, you know, that's what we pass on to our children. That's the first sound we hear. It's from a female. It's from the mother. I started playing conga drums in 1968. I was a student at the University of Washington, and I happened to be down at the Pike Street Market that a lot of people know about. They often have musicians on the street. They're playing congas and bongos and Cuban music. And I thought, wow, I really like this. So after they finished their set or whatever, I went up to one of the guys and told him how much I enjoyed the performance and really liked the music. He said, well, we're giving a class at the University of Washington. So I started going to that class, and that was the end of... that was the beginning of my destiny, I guess. The drum represents migrations of people. The drum represents the diaspora. The drum is an incredible instrument. When you start learning to play drums, one door opens up to two doors. Those two doors opens up to four doors. Those four doors open up to eight doors. And it's a never ending. It doesn't end. Art and music is the salvation, really. Our art will save our identity. Because maybe we don't speak the same language, but we can be moved by the same piece of music. And you know what? I'll tell you what. Like right now here in the United States, I'm an American. I'm proud to be an American. I have Native American blood, and my ancestors are in this soil. But we're going through a really hard time right now with this election and everything. And yet and all, I've been very upset about the whole thing. But when I go, I have classes every day. When we start playing those drums, I forget all about that, and I'm transported to a place of calm and peace. It's medicine. It takes me out of that, nanny, 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 all that fighting and all that's going on. And it takes me to a place of healing.
That story was produced by KALW's Alexandra Augustin, a visiting journalist from Austria. The next Women Drummers International Workshop happens December 4th at Ashkenaz in Berkeley. All that information is at KALW.org. Click Cross Currents. And that's our show today. The team includes Jürgen Klemm, Lila Day, Chris Hoff, Nina Gensler-Debs, Angela Johnston, Olivia Henry, Jeremy Ju, Ted Muldoon, Lisa Morehouse, Stephen Short, Carrie Spivak, and Andrew Stelzer. Our managing editor is Jen Chien. Managing producer is Julie Kane. Ben Trefney is our news director. Today's show was engineered by James Rowlands. The line producer was Hannah Kingsley Ma. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. This music is by Be Calm Honcho from San Francisco. They perform Saturday night at the Milk Bar on Haight Street. Doors open at 8 o'clock. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.
Are you going to commit the big one? Pull out your big guns. Blaze a trail. Go on the run. I'm essential as a knife. I've got that in me too. The kick, the thrash, the throw. Murder.